Hello, and welcome to Stepping Into Truth, the podcast where we take on the issues of race, gender, and social justice. I'm your host, Omkari Williams, and I'm very pleased that you're here with me today. It is really a joy for me to host this podcast. I'm privileged to speak with people who are out in the world making a difference with their day jobs, their programs, their art, their activism. If you would like to support me in doing this work, you can do so for as little as $3 a month by becoming a member of my Patreon community. You can go to patreon.com/OmkariWilliams and sign up. There's also a link on my website, OmkariWilliams.com. My guest today is Clint Borgen, founder and president of the Borgen Project, an organization working to bring U.S. political attention to global poverty. Borgen works nationally with congressional leaders to build support for legislation that improves conditions for people in developing nations. He's widely regarded as one of the leading poverty reduction campaigners in the United States, and I am delighted to welcome Clint to the podcast. Hi, Clint. I'm so pleased that you're here today. How are you?
I'm great. Yeah, I appreciate you bringing me on here.
Absolutely. It feels like an important subject to talk about, especially as we're at this beginning of a new administration with a lot of potential opportunities as I see it. So before we get into that, I want to go back to the beginning of this whole thing for you and have you talk about how you came to start the Borgen Project.
Sure. Yeah, growing up, I'd always been sort of engaged in just, I guess, the fact that there was a very different world outside what I grew up in. I grew up in a small town in the Northwest, about an hour from the Canadian border, and I had, you know, pretty sheltered upbringing up there and wasn't exposed to extreme hunger or poverty or anything like that. And I remember as a, like, even like a kindergartner watching some of the images on TV of the famine that going on in Ethiopia at the time and just being absolutely shocked that that could, that could be existing in such a different world than what I knew for sure. So kind of from a very young age, I had in the back of my mind that I wanted to go overseas and try to do something, help in some capacity. And then I guess during my sophomore year of college, actually, the Kosovo war broke out and there's ethnic cleansing going on over there. And about 10,000 people were killed in 3 months, 800,000 driven from their homes. Got quite a bit of media coverage, which is why I was seeing it and aware of it. And just kind of decided it might be a good, at that point, an adult and old enough to go try doing something. So I found an organization I could go volunteer with and went out there for a couple months. I was out there and just really woke me up to a lot of stuff. I just absolutely was amazed that it doesn't take a whole lot to improve conditions for people who are in refugee camps, who just fled a war crisis, that basic needs of food, water, shelter. It's not terribly difficult to provide that for people in the grand scheme of things. So this on the ground, the issues definitely didn't seem as complicated as when we talk about world hunger, it seems like this massive thing. But when you see, at least in a situation of people fleeing violence and needing very direct immediate assistance temporarily, seemed very addressable. And the other side of that was, boy, I was really upset that the U.S. wasn't doing more to address these issues. And I came back to put it bluntly, very pissed off and just annoyed that more wasn't being done to help people. And the more I researched it and dug in, that particular crisis received a lot more assistance than most places get from the U.S. and the global community. And yeah, just for me, it's just a very different view of U.S. foreign policy from what I grew up. I grew up with this patriotic view of the world, thinking the U.S. was out saving the world and doing all sorts of wonderful stuff. And not to take away, because we definitely do. There's a lot of amazing programs and efforts going on. But when you look at, you know, the role we have as kind of the world's superpower and the ability to get stuff on the global agenda, whether it's the war on terror, war on drugs, or whatever happens to be on any given administration's mind, we just have a unique platform to do a lot to address whatever issue as a country we kind of set towards. So that's kind of where I was looking at. And then you start digging into the stuff more. And, you know, Kosovo was one of the most heavily mined countries in the world at the time. There's just landmines everywhere. I remember even like, we're driving out in the middle of nowhere and stopping and needing to go to the bathroom next to the side of the road. And the driver's like, don't leave the concrete. And the reason you can't leave the concrete is you don't know what you're going to step on. And so just stuff like that. And then realizing that at the time, the U.S. was one of a handful of countries that never signed the treaty to ban landmines. And I just, right. How on earth had we not signed this treaty By the way, the veterans of the Vietnam War were the ones that got the Nobel Peace Prize for trying to get all these other countries to sign the treaty. So there's just, to me, it was just this huge disconnect as the more I kind of dug into it, of what I thought the U.S. was doing globally and what most Americans think the U.S. is doing globally and what was actually occurring on the ground. So for me, it was very clear that there needed to be a political aspect to addressing these issues, or getting U.S. leaders doing more to address these issues. A big part of that is public awareness, public education, because most people like me just had no idea that we just sort of kind of go about our day and assume all is well. And so my vision was really to create a powerful ally for the world's poor, essentially kind of like K Street for the starving kids, if you will, of just an entity that could put pressure on members of Congress and get them doing more to address poverty than they otherwise would. So started it shortly after college, you know, just out of college, still had student loans and stuff to pay off. I graduated like 2 months after September 11th. So the economy was not in the best of shape either. So I was kind of like, well, now's probably as good a time as any to try to do this. And I'd grown up in a small fishing town in the Northwest where a lot of my peers and classmates would take jobs living up on fishing boats in Dutch Harbor, Alaska, and working up there. And my mom actually worked as a bookkeeper for one of these fishing companies also. So had a unique opportunity, if you will, that they would hire someone in the off season to live on the fishing boat while the crew was gone for 3 months stints at a time. So for me, it was like the perfect deal because most of the other guys didn't want to do it because it's boring and lonely and the boat's docked to this cannery. But for me, I needed time and I needed my basic living expenses covered, which, you know, I got a salary and a free place to live. And so for me, it worked out good, but the early first year of the organization, I go up for 3 months at a time, then come back to Seattle for a couple months, then go back again. But that's where all the early paperwork was done. It's just me sitting alone at this fishing boat that was docked next to this cannery up there in Dutch Harbor, Alaska. And for those who watch the TV show, The Deadliest Catch, that's where it's filmed. Like, all those guys are working out of there. So I just sat up there, and is ultimately really kind of the perfect conditions for a startup too, because living quarters where I was at, there's no windows. It was down at like sea level inside the boat, the kitchen galley area there. And Alaska, as everyone knows, is very dark in the winter too. So you kind of just lose sense of day and night, and you just can do the long hours needed to do all the research and web development and all that stuff that needs done. So that was my existence about the first year and a half of the organization. I moved back to Seattle. Pretty soon I kind of transitioned where I was working night jobs. And then at one point we had enough money to open an actual office. We had this tiny little office in Seattle there and started to bring on interns and volunteers and people to help.
That must have been amazing.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. I actually have a lot of fondness for the early days too. There's goods and bads of each stage of an organization's growth. But things were definitely simpler back in those times. But so then, you know, pretty soon we're meeting with members of Congress directly, and that kind of started to grow. And at this point, we meet with anywhere from 90 to 95% of the U.S. Senate. Really have a strong platform to build support for a lot of these programs and meet with key committees in both the House and the Senate. And you know, the results have been really good in recent years. And the first few years, I wouldn't say accomplishing a lot compared to what we do now by any means, but it took several years of
It's a process. It's always going to be a process. Yeah. But what you said just actually brings me to another question that I had, which is that in your bio, you say specifically that what you're doing is working to bring United States political attention to global poverty. And that's a really specific thing. And I'm curious about why you are focusing on political attention, because I don't think that that's where most people necessarily think focus needs to be. So why is that your focus?
Yeah. So initially it was just seeing on the ground, realizing how much of the assistance comes from governments. So even you can look at some of the largest relief agencies in the world, World Food Program, World Vision, and you look at their budgets, a pretty huge percentage of it comes from grants from government nations. So grants in the US, grants from UK, Japan, go down the list, a lot of other countries. So in terms of scale of impact, if you can get leaders, and the amount the US gives, by the way, is pretty small compared to what most people think. On average, most people think it's 25% of the federal budget goes to international aid. In reality, it's less than 1%. So, you know, the amount going is really quite minuscule. But the level of impact we have with that is really pretty phenomenal compared to what any one agency, any one NGO or non-governmental organization can accomplish. So there's that component of it, just the force multiplier of like, I'll give you an example. We worked on the bill called the Water for the World Act. The objective is to help get 50 million people access to clean water. That bill passed 4 years ago. Our budget at the time was like around 300,000-400,000 a year. And that was just one of several bills we were working on. Other groups were involved as well too, but getting that passed, the number of people that'll be helped by that one bill alone of several bills, many bills we've passed at this point, I never in my life could have raised enough if we were just a direct aid agency building wells and doing that in my lifetime. So a lot of times you get one of these bills passed, you're able to accomplish more than you could as like a standalone non-government, you know, standalone nonprofit working just on building wells in developing countries, if that kind of makes sense. So
no, it does. I honestly hadn't thought about it that way, but when you say that makes perfect sense, because if you can get a bill like that passed, then A, the amount of money that USAID or someone else is going to dedicate to that project going to be far more than you as a small NGO would be or small nonprofit would be able to do on your own. So that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's actually something important for people to remember when they're doing their own activism and they're thinking, are these calls to my congresspeople making any difference? And they really
absolutely
can.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to sort of jump off on that because your organization has a very specific 4-point methodology strategy. And in connection to what we were just talking about, I want to ask you how that works, why you feel that that is the best, most effective model for you to use. And the 4 points are congressional relations, mobilize, education, and issue messaging. So how did you come to decide that those things together were the most effective means of proceeding?
Yeah, so this is kind of a neat part, I think, of the organization. So I start out very skeptical that members of Congress paid attention to emails, especially those generic form emails. I was definitely, when I started the organization, not a believer and based off no facts at all, but just I was assumed political leaders didn't
listen,
didn't
care. Yeah, I think
you've
got a lot of company with that assumption.
Yeah, so my early idea was like, well, I just need to create this powerful entity and get the big meetings and then we'll meet with them and lobby for the world's poor. So I don't know, fairly midway into the organization, we were getting the big meetings. We were having members of Congress join our board of directors. We had all these congressional staffers who were very friendly to the cause and giving us great insight and feedback. The thing I kept hearing over and over again was you really need to be mobilizing people in congressional districts across the country, have them email, have them write letters to Congress, have them call offices. And this was information I was getting from, you know, actual members of Congress who are engaged in the issue of global poverty and their staff. And initially I was sort of skeptical and I'm probably guilty of brushing it off initially and not putting a lot of stake in it. But then at some point it started to click. We did start bringing volunteers in at a national capacity and having them do a lot of these things, email Congress, reach out. And just the results were, it was quite shocking how quickly it started to work. And one board member is a former member of Congress. And he always talks about if he has 5 people call his office in the morning on any given bill or issue, by the afternoon, a staff has notified him. So a lot of these offices, they'll hear a ton about certain issues, right? Like immigration or whatever the hot item issue is at the time and whatever's on talk radio at the time. But your average is bill or average issue doesn't necessarily, aside from the 2 or 3 they're hearing a bunch of calls on, they're not getting that many calls and other stuff. And we've had congressional staffers give us the actual call logs that the political leaders receive on a weekly basis, showing them each call and issue. And it's just shocking how many few people actually are calling in support of any given bill. Or so that kind of started to click with us that, okay, this makes a difference. And we started to really build out our grassroots. And at this point, I could go on for an hour in different stories of where, like, I'll be meeting with a member of Congress and they're like, yeah, we hear a lot from your supporters in our district and they keep up the great work and yada, yada. And there's one in particular, he's a senator out of Mississippi. And I was kind of surprised to hear we had a lot of supporters, that they're hearing a lot from our supporters. And we can go back and look at the data on our end of like how many people emailed each senator in each state in any given senator. And that particular one, we went back and looked, he'd only had like probably 15 people email him from Borgen Project supporters in support of this bill. But in their office's view, it seemed like a lot of Borgen Project supporters, and you know, they're getting meeting requests from some of our volunteers. And so it always amazed me how few people it actually takes to do this, to kind of get some movement and traction on any given bill. But big picture is as citizens of the US, everyone in their given congressional district has a whole lot of power and influence over their leaders on whether they realize it or not. I'll be completely upfront. You know, you're not necessarily going to have a ton of luck if you're trying to change someone who's pro-life from the opposite stance and vice versa. So, you know, it's pro-choice, pro-life. Some of those hard stance issues, that's going to be hard to like sway someone on, right? But when it comes to stuff like this, if some basic bills and things going through as individuals, if you're emailing your congressional leaders, if you're reaching out, getting four or five friends to do it or family members, you're pretty much instantly getting that issue on the leader's radar at least. And then the more they're hearing from others, it just really kind of escalates. And sometimes we'll get leaders to co-sponsor a bill after like five or six people email them in support of it. And a lot of times we'll get emails from their staff. Thanks for reaching out. Or, you know, so, and especially the House of Reps, these are a lot smaller districts. They represent 600,000 people. Very few of those are actually in contact with their leaders as well.
That's amazing. And I've worked in politics. I honestly did not realize that that small a number of contacts could have an impact in that way. And that's incredibly encouraging, actually, because I think most people are so disconnected because they feel like, what's it going to matter what I do? And this is really encouraging. It's like, no, you and four of your friends can actually make a difference in this. That actually brings me to two bills that were passed in Congress in the last 2 years that particularly struck me. And because I think something people don't always pay enough attention to is how interconnected the problems that we face are. And the two bills that passed that jumped out at me were the Entrepreneurship and Economic Empowerment Act. And that passed in January of 2019. And then the Global Fragility Act, and it's an initiative to identify and prevent the main sources of fragility across the globe. And by fragility, they're talking about places that are liable to fall into conflict.
Right.
And that passed in December 2019. So the Entrepreneurship and Empowerment Act is about gender inequality as a key factor of women making up the majority of the world's poor. Yeah. And those two things are so interconnected because when you have conflict, the first people who are negatively impacted by that are going to be the women and the children.
Right.
So those two bills working together actually can really make a big difference. And I know that that's something that's been on the radar of the Borgen Project, and that when those bills passed, that was something that you all were quite pleased about. So I'm curious as to where else you are finding connections that are not necessarily the most obvious connections for people, and how we should approach looking at these kinds of things so that we can expand our activism and its impact when we're talking to people, our members of Congress.
Yeah, you know, so most likely everyone who follows your podcast, because you're very engaged in these issues and are very like aware of why this stuff matters. But I think it is important for us as advocates who care about these issues is to be able to talk with those who aren't about it. When we meet with members of Congress, and I'll just do this in my life in general, when I go out and speak, there's always someone who's against foreign aid or against the U.S. assisting. And but the big thing we like to point out is, you know, the U.S. has a foreign policy and we have a domestic policy, and we're just trying to get the foreign policy part more focused on improving lives and improving living conditions globally overseas. And why we do that is because we care about these issues and care about people. But even for those who really don't care at all about people and don't care about those living in poverty, it's important to realize these issues have a huge impact on the economy here domestically in the U.S. and also national security. So on the economic side, it's over 50% of U.S. exports now go to developing countries. And you look at all of our top trading partners, I think every single trading partner is our top trading partners at one time had been receiving U.S. foreign assistance. You look at the EU, you know, during the Marshall Plan, and South Korea, Japan. So all these countries that at one point had a little help from us and other nations to get the ball rolling and become these huge economic powers that they are now. And now we're doing a bunch of trade and business with them. That is a huge return on investment for the United States. And we actually, on our site, there's a page that breaks down like how much was spent on helping this country and how much the U.S. now receives every year in terms of exports from that country that has now graduated off assistance, is now part of the global economy. And it really is, it's like the greatest investment ever. I mean, it's you're helping people help themselves out of poverty. And lo and behold, a few years down the road, they're buying up apples from Washington State. They're buying wheat products out of the Midwest. They're buying Colgate toothpaste. You kind of go down the list. And what some of the early research on it, when we first started diving into this, it kind of made sense that the smaller scale items that, you know, as people transition from barely surviving into smaller level poverty, that those sort of made sense to me. But even like, you know, I'm out here in Washington State where the big employer out here is Boeing, and they make, you know, giant commercial 737 aircrafts. And when I've gone to Ethiopia, I fly on 747s that were built in the factories here, right near where I grew up, and where my aunt and uncle and my cousins, all these other people I know worked there and were making these aircrafts that were being bought up by Ethiopia Airlines or another region where poverty rates are dropping and they're able to expand and more people are flying. It's interesting, but you go down the list, the largest commercial contract Boeing ever did, it wasn't with an airline out of the US or Canada or Europe. It was an airline out of Indonesia. And, you know, historically one of the poorest countries on earth, but as poverty rates have been dropping there, there's a rising number of people who can actually afford to fly and are buying up airplane tickets from the big airline out there, Lion Airlines, and in exchange, Lion Airlines is buying up 737s off the factories here in the United States. And that's creating a bunch of jobs in the United States. So it's really interesting, but it's really, you can pick any product. We have friends of the family who are wheat farmers down in Oregon, and I got to talk to him one time. He's wasn't engaged in foreign aid at all, not a big fan. And I asked him, well, where does most of your wheat go? Oh, it all goes to South Korea. And, you know, this family's entire income is based off the fact that the U.S. made investments in Korea after the Korean War to help get that country on the right track. And in exchange is now one of our top trading partners, and probably a good chunk of it was coming from those aid investments the U.S. made in the past. When I was in Alaska, the fishing, you know, the one boat I worked on, they'd bag the fish and it was all heading to China. Like almost every single fish I ever saw working up in Alaska was heading to China. So all these fishermen and their entire livelihoods is based off the fact that a lot of these countries in Asia were buying up the fish in markets. And China is a good example that, you know, they cut hunger in half between 1990 and 2005. So there's obviously a lot more people who have entered the global market, if you will, and are able to buy products coming out of the U.S.
That's really interesting, because I think often we don't think about it in those terms. And, you know, people do get rather chippy about, oh, we should keep our money here. We shouldn't be supporting these things overseas. Yeah. But if we had a deeper understanding of the benefit here, I think people might change their minds about that and understand, especially now in this incredibly interconnected world in which we live. You can't just say that something happening on the other side of the world isn't going to impact us. And Actually, that leads me to, how have you adjusted doing your work in the era of COVID? Has that had any impact on the reception that you've gotten and how you've had to engage?
So it's actually not impacted us too much overall. A lot of our staff works is in different parts of the world in the US. So a lot of us were working remotely. There's a handful of us in the office in Seattle, but then a good chunk were working remotely to begin with. So that didn't have a huge impact. We have been doing advocacy around getting COVID-19 funding in the international affairs budget. So that's been a challenge, as you hear about these packages and how they're stalling in Congress. We're behind the scenes as groups like us that are trying to get at the moment $10 billion in COVID relief for some of these developing countries. So overall, in terms of our operations, it hasn't had too bad of impact. Truthfully, we've seen a lot more people volunteer, a lot more people get involved in the grassroots. So it's actually, in a lot of ways, it's not to find too much positive in a horrible thing, but it has brought a lot more people who now have time to participate in advocacy and want to get involved and do something on it. So that part has been a little bit of a shining thing that's come out of it. But overall, yeah, it's a challenge to get the U.S. focused on. And truthfully, and I'll be the first to say, you know, we all are having our own struggles here dealing with COVID. So it's not always the easiest thing to like, okay, by the way, we really need to address overseas too, because guess what? As long as it exists anywhere, it's going to exist here. And we need to be proactive in doing what we can. Our big concern right now as organizations, we really just have no idea the impact it's having on these developing countries. We can see the official data on how many countries have it, what number of caseloads, deaths. One of our staffers is in Egypt, and she always points out, like, they have no idea the number is. The government doesn't want to know. They're not tracking it. They're not getting people tested. So I think that's the case in a lot of different countries. So we really just, at this stage, don't have a really, we know it's hurting a ton of communities globally, but we just don't have any concept of how big it might be, what's affecting these regions.
Yeah, I'm hoping that with the new administration, that changes to some degree. I mean, it's never going to change entirely, because if the government doesn't want to know, the government isn't going to know.
Right.
So
yeah,
there's very little to be done about that. And it, then it comes down to the people actually on the ground to make the difference that they can make, which is very, very challenging at the moment. So world poverty, I think that when people hear that, they have a very specific idea in their heads about what poverty looks like. And I think people in the United States, I think our idea of poverty is very, very far removed from what right. poverty around the world actually looks like. Would you give us an overview of world poverty, what it means, and which places are hardest hit right now and what you see for the future?
Yeah, so Horn of Africa at the moment is the big hard hit one. And this has fluctuated through history too, by the way. Like China used to be, people used to grow up telling their kids, eat your dinner, you know, they're starving people in China. That country's made a lot of progress. So it does fluctuate on where the regions are. But overall, poverty rates have drastically improved. At least the number of people living in hunger have just improved drastically in the last 20 years. COVID is setting it back. We're definitely going to see an increase in poverty. I think the best definition is if you don't have the money to provide for your basic human needs of food, water, shelter, healthcare. And that's kind of what it boils down to in a lot of ways. You are very correct. Poverty, this is sort of a balancing act I do when people ask about what about poverty here is I want to be very mindful that yes, it's horrible here. I mean, there's real poverty issues. It has a real impact on people's lives. But when we talk about starvation level poverty in some of these countries, I mean, a lot of these places I've been, there's no dumpster to dive in. And if there was, there'd be like 50 people surrounding it trying to get the fighting for the food too. So like just the level of resources that these countries don't have is appalling. That doesn't take away anything from the experience of poverty of people here or there, but it's just important to realize they're just different scales of hardship for sure. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but
no, you are. No. Yeah. That I think that that's an important thing because, yeah, I mean, we do have very poor people here, and there are people who go to bed hungry. There are people right. who are unhoused, not by choice. Especially, I mean, COVID obviously is having a really, really negative impact yeah. on a lot of people who are already just living on the edge. But there's a difference between what we experience here in the United States as yeah. poverty in a country that actually has some resources and there are structures in place that can yeah. be of assistance as opposed to places in Africa where there are no structures in some countries at all to be of assistance. So, yeah. I mean, in Africa, you know, I think people sometimes forget how large that continent is and diverse, how diverse it is.
Yeah.
And Africa, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, there was tremendous progress being made. And then it sort of seems to have not only come to a halt, but in many places it's gone backwards. Right. And so what do you see as the potential for the U.S. engaging in meaningful ways to address some of the worst poverty that we see in Africa and other hard-hit places around the world?
I think it's there. There's definitely more awareness among, I can say, at least political leaders that Africa is important to the U.S. on a strategic level. The example, you know, everyone here talks about is China is having a really big influence out in that region, doing a lot of projects out in that region. And that government in particular is really good in terms of at least thinking 100 years down the road. And they're very strategic. They don't live in the election cycle of a lot of our political leaders here. So when they're spending billions more than we are in terms of development projects and work out there. So I think that has ruffled some feathers in Congress, and there's a little bit more engagement around the fact of that. The tough part is, though, when it comes to actual crunching, doing the budget, when they do the appropriations, there just historically hasn't been a huge constituency of people saying, we need more money for international assistance in the world's poor. You know, that's kind of what the Morgan Project has been trying to create through the years. But you hear a lot of people who care about Medicare or care about issues that more directly impact them, but there hasn't been as loud or vocal advocacy around this particular issue. And part of that is it doesn't directly impact, even though it impacts all of our lives in a lot of different ways, but it doesn't have that same sense of like, they're about ready to cut Medicare, or they're about ready to cut the transportation funding, or kind of go down the list of stuff that tends to galvanize public attention and support around. So I am optimistic. The awareness is there. It is challenging on the appropriation side of like actually getting them to prioritize this issue over a host of other issues. And in fairness to political leaders, it's just amazing the amount of issues that come to them and things that need funded and great things that need funded. I mean, even within the areas we focus on, there's everything from human rights to hunger to global diseases. And we're, as an organization, have to prioritize which ones to focus our attention and energy on and leave behind a host of really wonderful issues. So if you're doing that as a political leader with every issue in the world, every issue in the country, it's hard. It's not easy.
Definitely. So you have said that world hunger could be eliminated by the year 2030 with an additional $265 billion a year in funding. And just to put that in some perspective, yeah, it costs the United States about $6 billion to build an aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
And if I'm correct, the U.S. budget of the World Food Program right now is currently about $6 billion as well. It's somewhere between, it's fluctuated, but it's somewhere in that $4 to $6 billion range. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think you're right. It might be a little lower, but it's in that ballpark. Yeah. It's definitely less than what we spend on like two stealth bombers or...
Right.
Or used to spend. We did stop that particular program.
But. Yeah, right. It's like, oh yeah, let's get a stealth bomber. Or, oh, you know, we could feed people. What should we do? So 2030, horrifyingly enough, is only 9 years from now. How did that happen so quickly? Is that still something that you see as a possibility if the engagement were there? Do you still see that as possible?
High level engagement, I think, for sure. And one thing to point out on some of these estimates, like the World Bank and some of these lot more brilliant people than me, like they put together what can be realistically achieved. And a lot of people are, or some people from the Millennium Development Goals, but world leaders got together and agreed to a time frame on cutting hunger in half by 2015. This was back in the 90s, and that was actually achieved already. So the number keeps going down up until COVID. So there is a lot of success occurring. But one thing to point out, there's like, just if you want direct aid, help everyone who's in hunger right now or in refugee camps, that's really affordable and doable. And then these other bigger numbers that you're mentioning, that gets into like long-term strategy of helping poor farmers increase their crop productivity and lifting the entire village out of poverty. And those do take a little bit more time, but it's, you know, just in the grand scheme of things and compared to what we've spent on wars and other stuff we've done, I mean, this is just a drop in the bucket compared to a lot of different expenses. Not to pick on defense contractors, because my brother works for a defense contractor and a good chunk of my family has different parts of the year. We have different views on certain things, but I will say the largest defense contractor in the world, which is Boeing right now, they get more from the US government to build military-related aircraft or weaponry or satellites in a lot of cases, I think, than the entire US spends on our international assistance program. So State Department, all the embassies, all the everything US does globally in terms of helping the world's poor, the entire State Department gets less money than one military contractor gets. It also gets less money than the second largest military contractor gets. So when we talk about the amount going to these issues being small, it's not just like, well, if we, this lofty idea, what if we gave more than we gave to the military? I mean, literally, if we gave more than we gave to our two largest defense contractors, we would see drastically different results too. So always try to be careful of that comparison, because I know a lot of people have strong feelings on it. But I think it's also worth noting a lot of top military strategists and a lot of our top defense heads of the DOD we've had in recent years have talked about the importance of development and investing in the term you hear a lot of soft power approaches, but it's really this lot of efforts where you go in and help people out of poverty, and that helps undercut the local terrorist groups or the drug cartels. Because one of the big lessons of 9/11, this was in the 9/11 Commission report too, they use the word development like a zillion times as they're describing what the United States needs to do to protect the U.S. moving forward. But one of the big realizations was Al-Qaeda and some of these groups, they would go into these just hard hit impoverished regions and they would do basic stuff like build a school or build hospitals and help out the local community or provide free education. stuff that, you know, if the U.S. was doing, we would be viewed more as a good guy and help undercut their efforts there. So several years back, I was over in Ethiopia near the border of Somalia, and I talked to a military official from the U.S. embassy, and he was saying they would go out to these villages and just talk to the local tribal leaders, find out what some of the basic needs were, and they might be providing books for the local village or helping put in a water well. And their motivation was obviously because they wanted to get intelligence from these tribal leaders on when, at the time, I think it was Al-Shabaab was coming through. So, and you go out to these villages, and the one I went to looked like a pretty hard hit area, but you'd see like the USAID bags, and the USAID had a presence out there. And in exchange, these military officials were finding out, you know, they wanted to make sure Al-Shabaab wasn't going to take over the entire Horn of Africa and have this huge presence. And so it's sort of just very interesting, but just on a very basic on the ground level, if you can help people, it definitely helps undercut the bad guys, if you will, and puts the U.S. in a lot more affordable way to tackle some of these groups and issues than the cost of weaponry and going in after the fact.
Absolutely. I mean, I was in Vietnam a few years ago and was in the South China Sea and was completely surprised to see a USAID banner on a little floating village where they were, I think, oyster fishing or something like that. And I thought, that is so interesting that literally in the middle of the South China Sea, this is what you find.
Yeah.
But it makes a difference. The people there had a very different perspective about the United States than they might otherwise have had.
Right.
That's something I think that all of us should keep in mind in our outreach to our elected leaders so that we can, it's another data point to support, this is why you should pay attention to this.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Well, our time is getting short, and I want to ask you two questions before we go. One is, as discussed, your stated goal is to make global poverty a priority of U.S. foreign policy. So how do we get there? Have your strategic plan for getting there? What does that look like for your organization to put that kind of pressure that would actually make that happen?
Yeah. You know, part of it we're doing as we speak. I mean, we're getting the meetings, we're building support for bills, we're getting legislation passed. Really, the thing that's on my mind most these days is just how do we make sure every single congressional district, there is a active, engaged demographic of people who are emailing members of Congress and support these bills, going to direct grassroots lobbying meetings with these members of Congress, because that's really where we're seeing the results. So really kind of continuing to build out that grassroots network of people is huge. And that's something we're focusing a lot of our efforts on at this stage, because that's really in from everything we're data point we're seeing, that's kind of where we're getting the best results. And that's where we'll continue to get the best results. And we just want to make sure every single member of Congress is feeling pressure and somewhat engaged. I will say too, a lot of these, there's one member of Congress, I won't mention his name, although he's pretty well known and outspoken about this, but he literally came to Congress for the specific purpose to cut foreign aid. That was his stated stance. We did a ton of meetings with him. We had a grassroots member there who was just awesome. And she alone did like 4 meetings with him. And then we did some direct ones with his office in DC. She was mobilizing a lot of people. Long story short, he's retired last year, but he'd become like a pretty good advocate on these issues. And I disagree with the man on just about everything, but he actually introduced one of the bills we worked on. So he went from like this person that on the surface were like, should we even bother trying to focus on, but we said, well, what the heck? And when he came in as a fresh member of Congress and just became a great advocate for these issues. And, you know, there's still always a lot of differences on his views on ours and a lot of different stuff, but this is a person that could have been a huge hindrance to these efforts and actually became someone very helpful in these issues. So, but we see this actually quite a bit, even among some Tea Party members. And Mark Meadows, who is Trump's chief of staff and a notoriously, difficult person, he co-sponsored several bills we brought to him. He knew there's grassroots people in his district. And, you know, just interesting. I mean, here's a guy who's all about cutting government funding, and you especially think these programs. But, you know, he met with me and met with a lot of our volunteers and did good, helpful work on this stuff, even though it kind of goes against his worldviews and everything. So I can't stress enough that a lot of these leaders you would think in never a million years wouldn't be involved. If nothing else, if you can get them where they're not holding up bills and not blocking bills and getting them just to kind of stay out of the way on the efforts to improve the world's poor. That's helpful too.
That's great. So the last thing I want to ask you is, and you just gave us certainly one, what are three simple things people listening can do to make a positive impact in this realm?
Yeah. So we hit on the email in Congress, and that's literally, there's a section on our site. You can do that as well. It tells you which bills are in Congress. I would do this with any issue at all you care about too, because I've been blown away by how effective it is. So if whatever causes you care about, whether it's issues domestically, issues globally, the environment, go down the list, I would follow or go to the websites of some of these groups and find out what they're advocating for and what the email to Congress is, because everyone gets tallied by the office. The leader, if nothing else, gets the tally saying 5 people, 10 people, 30 people emailed in support of that given bill. And that helps a lot. So number one, be emailing. That's a pretty quick 30, 60 second effort. Ideally, if you can mobilize, again, 5 or 6 people, that really adds value. If you can get 5 or 6 people to call that leader's office in support of that bill in the same, ideally in the same day, it doesn't hurt though if it's spread out a little bit. These are kind of random things to just sort of get attention. The big states, California, New York, if you reach out to Senate offices, it's a little more challenging just because they hear from a lot more people. But in terms of your average congressional district of House representative, where they have 600,000 people, anyone can get those members of Congress representatives pretty engaged. So email, mobilize. And then we do have volunteer and internship opportunities on our website as well for people looking to have a more involved role. That's always helpful too.
Great. And the website will be in the episode notes for this show. And I'm really, really grateful that you were able to take the time to speak with me, because this has been so enlightening and I've learned so much. And thank you so much for taking the time, Clint.
Likewise, I love what you're doing. I keep up the great work.
Thank you so much. You have a good one.
You too.
Global poverty and the hunger that goes alongside it are massive issues. No one of us can solve the entire problem, but working together, we can make things better. Don't let the scope of the problem stop you from doing what you can. This, like all social justice issues, is about cumulative actions. If this cause speaks to you, decide what you can do to make a difference, and then keep doing it, knowing that your actions, added to those of others, will make a difference. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back with another episode of Stepping into Truth very soon. And until then, remember that change starts with story, so keep sharing yours.